You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of December 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show,
we will stop racing to topple foreign regimes that we know nothing about, that we shouldn't be involved with. Instead, our focus must be on defeating terrorism and destroying ISIS.
The president-elect and newly anointed Time magazine Person of the Year makes some pronouncements on foreign policy. Do we yet understand how Donald Trump sees the world? My guests Ivo Gaber and Tom Rivers will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the latest on the UK's efforts to leave the EU. Should the country have left a trail of breadcrumbs as it went in? Julian Assange's leaking of his testimony to Swedish prosecutors. What, if anything, does it actually tell us? And how do you report on the king in a country where you can't really report on the king? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Ivo Gaber, Professor of Journalism at the University of Sussex, and Tom Rivers, London correspondent for ABC Radio News. Welcome both. And we will start tonight in the United States, where President-elect Donald Trump has described his receipt of Time magazine's Person of the Year award as a tremendous honour, suggesting that he, like the indignant legions kicking off across social media, has failed to appreciate that the prize recognises impact rather than virtue, and has previously been won by Nikita Khrushchev, Adolf Hitler, the Ayatollah Khomeini, Vladimir Putin, and Joseph Stalin twice. More significantly, perhaps, the president-elect has made a speech on military policy, appearing to outline a predictably isolationist approach. Tom, first of all, it must have been a dreadful temptation to Time magazine not to give it to him, given that he famously kicked off last year when Merkel got it and he didn't. It would have been very funny not to give it to him, but they had to, really, didn't they?
They had to, exactly. Number two, apparently, was Hillary. Number three were the hackers. And it's interesting, as you say, just a few, was it a year or two ago, he came in and said he was very critical of the list. He said, bad list, when they mentioned the top 100.
When he said bad list, he just said bad with an exclamation mark, didn't he? That would have been the
I think he said bad list, Andrew. But he said it's a, I think he said, he tweeted, he said this is a magazine that's eventually going to go the way of Newsweek, I think. So he was getting his digs in, but he said it's tremendous honor today. So what, very different position.
It has been pointed out that the pose that in which they have sat Donald Trump, sort of sitting in a chair with looking to one side, is not, it's not a million miles removed from a 1941 cover of Hitler, which wasn't his Man of the Year cover, but is there a chance that a picture editor at Time was having a bit of a chuckle there?
Perish the thought. Journalists having lacking in integrity. Actually, that thought struck me. And I have to say, it's probably not a coincidence. However, the question that it raised in my mind is, 20 years ago, Time was the big weekly international magazine. Mm-hmm. How much does it matter now?
Well, you know what matters, because we're talking about it. And everybody's talking about it. And then the social media, which we didn't have 20 years ago, is talking about it. So I think it still has some punch.
How much do people still talk about Time magazine the other 51 weeks of the year, though?
Certainly considerably less. That is true. But the name is out there today. It's in every hourly radio newscast. At least now, maybe in the next few hours, it'll start getting kicked down.
Is there a curse of Time Man of the Year? You know, we have this sort of, in English football, for example, Manager of the Month invariably then goes into that. Can we? I won't say hope because we're totally neutral, but I wonder if there's a curse of the Man of the Year.
I don't think there is. Nothing associated with this one.
I think it's the nature of the kind of people who receive the Person of the Year of the award that, you know, they're playing for fairly high stakes. A certain quantity of them tend to get their comeuppance sooner or later. But I don't think there is a... a curse attached.
What year did Hitler win it? I should have researched
1938,
that.
I think I'm right in saying.
He had a few years to go.
Yeah, he had a few unfortunately. The beginning of the end, you could argue. We should probably look at something more substantial, which is this speech he gave in Fayetteville. Mm-hmm. The key line was, as we heard at the top, we will stop racing to topple foreign regimes that we know nothing about, that we shouldn't be involved with. Now, Tom, first of all, is that hugely different from what George W. Bush and Barack Obama said when they took over? George Bush, you know, famously had no interest in nation building. Barack Obama was all about not doing dumb stuff.
Well,
doesn't every U.S. president try to be isolationist?
Well, no. I mean, George W. Bush said he wasn't into nation building. But of course, he went into after Afghanistan, he went into Iraq. And Mr. Obama did his business in Libya, and he's been poking Syria for the last few years. So, you know, maybe they were singing, believe it or not, from the same sheet as far as regime change goes in that part of the world.
I mean, isn't he going to inevitably slide into it? He makes his priority, he said, doing the bad guys, you know, mm-hmm. ISIS. Mm-hmm. You ain't going to do that in America. He's got to go in. If he's serious about it, he's got to go in and intervene. And then what do they do? I mean, if he's successful, walk away, leave the regime to collapse? No, they're into nation building, whether they like it or not. That's the role of a superpower.
Well, look at what Obama inherited, had to carry on in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and now we've got Trump's going to have to deal with a long protracted whatever kind of help assistance from Turkey, wherever. In Syria, so you just can't cut off and say that's it, that's done. Aleppo sorted the whole thing. It's not all sorted. It ain't. It's going to be.
Well, Obama made the point, I think, in his recent speech that he is the first president to have served two terms, all of them spent at war. So obviously, Donald Trump does inherit that, whether he likes it or not. But it's very hard trying to frame Donald Trump's thinking against that of previous presidents, because he is from a completely different world to all of them. But everything he's talking about, the staying out of things that don't concern us, while combining with a promised build-up in military spending, are we looking at an invocation, whether Trump realizes it or not, of Theodore Roosevelt's tread softly but carry a big stick?
I wish it was that coherent. I mean, I almost said, when you said Donald Trump's thinking, I said, there goes another oxymoron, but didn't. I don't think it's that coherent. Teddy Roosevelt did have a strategy. It looks to me, and I sincerely hope I'm wrong, but he's just making it up as he goes along.
Well, yes, the thought rather occurred to me when he uttered the line, "In short, we seek peace through strength." Tom, I suspect he didn't write that one himself.
No, that's kind of a post-truth kind of ism, isn't it? It's kind of scary, but he wants to build up the military. He also wants to build up, and it's desperately needed, the infrastructure in America, airports, bridges, roadways, and that's grand and glorious. I don't know where the money's coming from, because he says 22, his words, $22 trillion in debt right now. Where's the money coming from for all of this?
Well, on that unanswerable question, I think we'll move on, because we will have plenty of further opportunities to address Donald Trump's view of the world. We will now turn our attention to the United Kingdom and the ongoing unfurling of the second daftest decision made by a sentient democracy in 2016. While the government continues its appeal against the Supreme Court's judgment that Parliament must be consulted before the ripcord is pulled, suspicions that nobody actually has any idea how the UK is going to leave the EU were not alleviated by the Prime Minister Theresa May yesterday, promising a red, white and blue Brexit. Ivor, you as the token British person at this table, do you have the least idea what that actually means?
I'm just sigh if I had a thought bubble, a red, white and blue Brexit. You know, which speechwriter wrote that junk? actually, there was a very clever news bullet. I think Channel 4 News in the UK yesterday took the red, white and blue and said, is it a Norwegian Brexit?
Yep.
Is it a French? Anyway,
yeah, exactly.
To go back to Icelandic, Dutch, Luxembourgeois, what others are there? So I'm a bit of a flag nerd. Australian, New Zealand. Anyway.
There's another 22 minutes to go.
Yeah, I'm just going to sit here and name countries with red, white and blue flags.
Meanwhile, back in the radio studio, I do think they don't know. Mm-hmm. I do think it's quite clear we have in this country three Brexit ministers who are all saying different things. I think that they, I mean, frankly, nobody had planned for this, which is fair enough. And I think that events are unravelling which aren't helping them. I'll just give you one example, which is Italy. Because Italy is, I think, is very bad news for the Brits, because...
That would be a red, white and green Brexit.
Thank you, Andrew. Returning to the subject in hand, what's the name for a person who studies flags, apart from very boring?
A vexillologist.
Seriously.
Very good.
I haven't often sat in a studio with a vexillologist. Anyway, as I was saying before I interrupted myself... I think if Beppe Grillo, the five-star movement, looks like it's going to become the largest party, at the moment they're opposed to the euro, but it won't take them long to make one step to talking about, I can't think of what, an Italian exit? You know, we've had a Brexit and a Grexit, but an Italian exit. So the thinking, I think, in the Commission would be, look, we are going to make the British exit as painful and as difficult as possible to deter anybody else from going down that road. So I think it's very bad news. And I think Barnier yesterday indicated that.
I don't know how much about pain, but they want it quick. I think it's an 18-month run to be done. And I was thinking, coming over here, Ivor, with your, these days, with your teaching, et cetera, et cetera. It is such, I think back to my university days, when you know, if I have to bang out a story for next hour, that's fine. But if I have to write a 200-page thesis, I never want to start the thing. And I think that's kind of where London, I believe that's where the government is now. They're just going, you know, they're dancing around it. But they don't want to... They don't want to start on page one, and that's the difficult situation right now.
So you're diagnosing an advanced case of writer's block.
Oh, I think so. Very much think so, yeah.
But I think to be fair, and I always am, we assume politicians know what they're doing. But sometimes, in the words of a famous British Prime Minister, Harold Macmillan, events, dear boy, events. Mm-hmm. Nobody anticipated Brexit. So in one sense, they should have said, if they were really... you know, going to be open. We didn't anticipate it. We haven't got a plan. We'll come back to you when we've worked out what we want to do. Mm-hmm. But of course, you know, that sort of honesty don't go down well with voters.
I mean, this is a fabulous illustration of the events, dear boy, events maxim. Ivor, the government does now appear to have acquiesced to the opposition's insistence that it publish some plan in advance. The line prior to that had been, we don't give a running commentary. Was that a deliberate strategic attempt to keep cards close to chest, or a way of avoiding saying, we haven't got the faintest idea how we're going to do this?
Well, I think saying we're going to keep our cards close to the chest would play a bit better than we haven't got the faintest idea what we're doing. and that's a bit of free political media advice. But I do think that, when we talk about Labour, they don't really have a coherent single. But Keir Starmer, who is their Europe spokesman, is pushing the government to reveal more and more. Uh-huh. It's not saying we're against it, but by pushing them to reveal more and more, my guess... and I'm hoping to go and hear him speak in a couple of days' time. Actually, what they want to do is force the government into a position where the deal and that is so poor that they actually need an escape hatch, which could be going back to the British people and saying, look, we want to be totally democratic. Here's the package. What do you think? But that's probably me whistling in the dark.
Tom, you mentioned there the EU negotiator, Michel Barnier, who was saying that he wants to wrap this up in 18 months rather than the 2 years and change the UK government appears to think it has. He also reiterated, as he put it, that the UK cannot cherry pick.
Right.
There's probably... Well, cherries are red. Can you get white or blue cherries?
I don't think so.
Moving
on. You can get green ones. I've definitely seen green ones.
Okay.
But anyway, does the UK, do you think, Tom, yet understand how severe a kicking the rest of the EU wants to give it on the way out?
I think on one hand they do, but on the other hand, and we talked about Italy, and I think Europe just wants a clean break. If they can get a few punches in, on the exit door, that's fine. But what they don't want is this thing lingering and hanging on, because others will think maybe this is for them too. I really think this could be the beginning. If Italy goes the wrong way, then this thing really is going to be spiraling.
Ivor, how serious a danger of contagion, if you will, do you think?
Well, I was going to follow up Tom. It doesn't end with Italy. It's not impossible that Marine Le Pen, who is completely committed to a Frexit, Wilders in the Netherlands will form the largest party. He probably won't form the government because of the coalition against him, but the largest party in the Dutch parliament will be anti-EU. And a narrow squeak was Austria. So, sure, the contagion is contagion.
Yeah.
You know, we're in a situation where if I was sitting in the EU Commission building in Brussels, I would be worried.
Mm. But just finally, then, I'll put this to each of you, Tom, first. At this distance, do we have or do you have, can you envision any idea of what Brexit will actually mean?
Can I just say Brexit is Brexit?
I was about to specifically add the codicil, you're not allowed to answer Brexit means Brexit. So, Ivy, you have the length of Tom's answer to come up with something better than that. Tom, what do you think it will look like?
What will the dovetail look like? It's fascinating because what do you do with all of the people that were in essence grandfathered, i.e. the EU citizens in the UK, the British citizens that live in Spain? What happens to them? What happens to the new generation coming up that, wow, you might need a visa to go to a Schengen country? It opens up a raft of, how much is your plane ticket going to go up, because we're going to have new fees going to the continent. A myriad of questions out there, and that's why it's this 200-page thesis that nobody wants to touch.
But I think in your answer and in the question, you exemplify why it was so easy for the Leave campaigners to say there will be this magic upland where we will be trading with our Australian and our New Zealand friends and we'll be making things. Whereas for the Remainers, life is more complicated because they tend to be more in touch with the harsh realities. So we have a messy, I don't know what Brexit's going to look like, nobody does, but I know it ain't going to be as good as the Leave campaigners told us.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Ivor Gaber and Tom Rivers. Coming up next, could London's Ecuadorian embassy be closer to getting shot of their house guest?
Hankering for a few ideas for the year ahead, or in mind of some reflection on the one that was? Monocle's mighty whacker of a December-January double issue is on newsstands now. What more could you want this festive season? Well, here's what our elfin editors have wrapped up for you.
In the affairs section, it's a soft power special. We're at the diplomatic training school in Myanmar. Plus, of course, this year's soft power survey, as a familiar face returns to the top spot.
In the business section, we start with 15 lessons to take with you into 2017, such as how best to rethink the food chain and how to run an eyewear shop with impeccable service.
In culture, we set our sextant to 2017 to gauge the high seas of culture, the best books, music, movies and art, and the ones to watch that make it for next year.
Monocle's Mammoth December-January double issue is on newsstands now. Pick up a copy today, or why not treat yourself to a subscription? Head to monocle.com to find out more.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Still with me are Ivor Gaber and Tom Rivers. Now, it's now a little over 4 years since WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange sought asylum at the Ecuadorian embassy in London, claiming asylum in order to avoid extradition to Sweden to face police questioning over allegations of rape dating back to 2010. Earlier this month, Swedish prosecutors visited Assange at his Knightsbridge Eyrie. Arguably, unsurprisingly, Assange has now leaked, if you will, what he claims is a transcript of the answers he gave them. Tom, does this latest development get Assange any closer to leaving, which would, I guess, technically be a red, blue and yellow exit?
Andrew, if it gets him closer to leaving, but after 4.5 years in self-imposed detention, I don't think he's in any mindset to say, let's play nice, let's be quiet, let's shut up, let's play by the Swedish rules. He is saying, well, if you read the transcript, you will agree with the UN's Working Group on Arbitrary Detention and say, I'm being stitched up. What are you doing? Look at what's happening to me. And they also shot down the appeal from the UK recently as well, saying you have no legal grounds.
There is an issue, is there not, with Assange's repeated use of the word detention, which does suggest that he's not free to walk out the front door anytime he feels like it, which he is.
It's a bad joke, though, isn't it? you're free to walk into the hands of the authorities.
Is it likely that if he went to was shipped back to the States, would he face a capital offence?
Well, it's far from certain that that would actually happen. This has always been the basis of his claim, that if he is extradited to Sweden, that will only be a way station en route to being extradited to the United States.
Yeah.
Is that a genuine concern on his part, though, or is he just trying to forestall?
No, I think it's a genuine concern. Look at how many times the Espionage Act has been imposed under President Obama, more than any other president. And he stirred things up so much that I think he's going to be in for some kind of reaction if he ever put his foot on American soil.
Ivor, does Julian... I mean, Julian Assange has arguably not been the... ideal advocate for his own cause. I think it's fair to say. Could he or should he have handled this rather differently?
Well, if you speak to any of the Guardian journalists who cooperated with him in the initial stages of the first big leaks, they would tell you he's not the easiest person to work with.
I am reliably informed that that would be an understatement.
Indeed, and I think that yes, he could have handled it. It's a bit of a mixed bag, because undoubtedly some of the work that WikiLeaks did was admirable, and exposing some of the American atrocities, I think is the right word, in Iraq was excellent, plus other things. However, that split about whether WikiLeaks should itself editorialized, should say, no, actually, if we release these documents, it will be problematic. It was a really fundamental split, which has led Assange, and he believed everything must be out there, and it's led Assange into a very dangerous situation and dangerous company. And I have to say, any remaining sympathy I might have had with him disappeared when I saw him working so hard to get Donald Trump elected.
Well, this is the thing, because WikiLeaks does editorialise, doesn't it? Because, as you know, Ivy, you editorialise as soon as you decide not to publish something and to publish something else. And do you think there's any doubt that WikiLeaks has become partisan in recent years, especially?
Well, in particular, in relation, I think the intervention in the US election was the first time, and I haven't followed everything WikiLeaks, but they had such a distinct line. They were clearly trying to, before, their manifesto was always all information should be free and out there. Mm-hmm. But at the time of the US presidential campaign, it was quite clear they were using their material. I think they crossed a line there, and it seems to me that freedom of information, freedom of expression campaigners, and I regard myself as one, would have to say at that point, excuse me, I think we're going to part company here.
What did you think, Tom? Did you get the impression, as many did, and I tended in that direction myself, that WikiLeaks had become kind of a PR arm for the Trump campaign?
Well, again, in his defense, and he said this, that I would publish information on Trump, but I don't have it at my disposal.
We have only his word for that, of course.
Exactly. Those are his words. He said if I had an equal amount of quote-unquote material on Trump, we would be out there. He said he didn't have it, so he can only publish what he says is sitting on his table. So that's his take. The second point is, I think after this lengthy period of time, he's so far down the rabbit hole that he said, I'm gonna throw some grenades and see what happens. Why not, if you're him?
Okay, well, finally tonight to Thailand, where it appears that the new king, or at least those close to him, intend to take as dim a view of criticism, real or imagined, as his late father's court. Thailand's laws on lèse majesté are infamously rugged, providing 3 to 15 years in the slammer on every charge of insulting the royal family and compelling the investigation of every complaint raised by any member of the public. One such appears to have been made against the BBC's Thai service, pertaining to a profile of the recently ascended King Maha Vajiralongkorn. Ivor, the issue here, as far as I understand it, appears to be that this profile, which was, you know, and BBC profiles are not, you know, renowned for being shrieking tabloid hyperbole, noted that the new king is perhaps not as popular as his father was. Now, that strikes me as the mildest statement of fact.
Well, I mean, these things are relative, aren't they? In Thailand, I was struck by people's apparent or real, and I don't say it really matters, dedication to the royal family. It's 6 o'clock in the evening, as the siren goes, everybody stops, the national anthem is played, and nobody moves till it's finished. Now, maybe they're worried about the secret police, or maybe they loved their king. But whatever it is, we're not in a situation whereby normal standards of freedom of expression pertain. I mean, Thailand is not a million miles away from other Asian countries, Malaysia, Singapore, where freedom of expression does not run, whose writ does not run very freely. So it wouldn't be an exception. So it's part of an authoritarian state, I'm afraid.
Tom, if you are an agency like the BBC or indeed the ABC working in a place like Thailand, where you run up against that, how do you work around it? If you really can't in any serious sense report on a particular aspect of the country, what do you do?
Maybe you just avoid putting out this biography. And you said at the top, if that's the most damning thing, saying that the son may not have the gravitas of the father, well, maybe that's the way it is. But maybe you just avoid that line, or maybe you don't even touch the story and you get on with other stories happening in the country.
But can it get to a point where you're so restricted that there's just no point in you being there? And it completely delegitimizes whatever journalism you do publish.
There can well be. But I think you have to pick and choose and understand exactly if you are shutting up today, meaning you can write a different story about a different subject tomorrow.
But presumably, the BBC is making the sort of decisions that Tom's talking about, say, in North Korea. They have a presence in North Korea, but I'm sure as hell they're very careful about what they do. And then you get that balance, that choice. Is it more important to have a voice? Is it more important to stay there and keep reporting, even if we're restricted? Or do we say, if we can't do what we want to do, we're leaving? Because in many countries of the world, the BBC is restricted. I mean, I have to say, I do think that they're right to keep their voice going wherever they can, even if it means being a bit more discreet than they might want to.
Is there an argument in a case like that for being, a little bit sly and a little bit activist in how you deal with these things? If you are the BBC and you have the reach of the BBC and you meticulously reported and broadcast absolutely every charge of lèse majesté that the Thai government imposes, because this is some fairly basic banana republic nonsense, that eventually does make the Thai government look foolish.
Yes, exactly. But again, it is a fine, fine line. And it's really, as Ivor says, it is right in that tightrope, and it's determining, when do you make your stand and when do you just kind of play by the rules and say, I'm going to be around for other things.
I had an insight into it. I would generalize here, a different attitude to the role of the journalist in Asia compared to Europe or the US, when I was doing a workshop on investigative journalism in China. And I was talking about how your job is to be you're troublemakers. Mm-hmm. You know the shtick. You're troublemakers. And at the end of it, and they were taking notes, at the end of it, a curious journalism student came up to me and said, you were talking about, do British journalists see themselves as troublemakers, investigative journalists at least? Mm-hmm. I said, yeah. He said, don't they think they should be contributing to the harmony of society? To which I said, I don't think so. And that was such a fundamental gap.
Such a fundamental gap.
I mean, to bring us back to where we came in, I guess, Tom, is it possible over the next 4 years that your American colleagues have to be braced to deal with a government which is less perhaps amenable to independent questioning journalism than has traditionally been the case?
Andrew, in a way, it may open up to more blank canvas, independent reporting, because you don't have to play games. You have to be nice. If it's going to be bare knuckles from the podium, it's going to be bare knuckles from the reporting core, potentially.
Isn't there actually a worry that the new occupant of the White House might actually take measures against reporting organizations that he doesn't like?
No, I don't think so.
You think the First Amendment will stand firm?
It stands. It's there. And, maybe it needs to be tested. And I think we're going to see a less cozy relationship. And that means it's going to be more objective reporting.
What do you think, Ivor? Do you share that optimism? I mean, it's not infrequently a criticism made of the establishment media in the United States that it is perhaps a little bit too friendly with the people in charge.
Well, I think there is a problem. I love Tom's optimism. I'll buy into it. But if you're a reporter, let's just say he decides CNN is part of the left-wing conspiracy, he's not going to talk to them. It's very problematic for a national network like CNN or NBC or ABC to do their job if the president is refusing to talk to them. And it's the power of the boycott which is as dangerous as the power of intervention.
Ivor Gaber and Tom Rivers, thank you both very much for joining us at Midori House. That's all we have time for on today's episode. It was produced by Carlotta Ribello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Helena Geriat. Our studio manager was Kieran Matthew Banerjee. More music next at 1900, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.